This is The Common Health from the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security, engaging senior leaders on questions of how to address our common health security challenges in this post-COVID moment.
Hello and welcome to a new episode. I'm Catherine Bliss with the CSIS Global Health Policy Center. And today we're going to talk about dengue, a viral disease transmitted by the Aedes aegypti mosquito. Dengue can cause mild symptoms, including fever, headache, and joint pain, but it can also progress to more severe disease, leading to hemorrhage, respiratory distress, and even death. Several regions of the world are vulnerable to dengue, primarily those where the Aedes aegypti mosquito is able to circulate and reproduce. And the Latin America and Caribbean region has experienced dengue outbreaks periodically over time, but they have become more regular and have affected a greater number of countries since the middle of the 20th century. Now, since the start of 2024, several countries in South America have experienced a rapid increase in dengue cases, which has overwhelmed health systems. According to the Pan American Health Organization, this year alone, at least 18 countries in the region have reported cases with 422 deaths. And the total number of cases for the first few months of this year is 245% higher than the same period in 2023, and 354% higher than the average over the past 5 years. Now, the number of cases in Brazil and Argentina is already more than 400% higher than in the first few months of 2023. And in the Andean subregion, which typically sees the numbers go up a little bit later in the year, around June, it's already seen 90% more cases compared to the same period in the past 5 years. And in Peru, the government declared an emergency in 20 districts at the end of February, by which point more than 30 people had died. And this is all on top of an outbreak the year before that was so severe it had political implications and led to the resignation of the health minister, Rosa Gutierrez, in June of 2023. I'm joined today for this conversation by Dr. Andres Willy Lescano, who leads the Emerging Infections and Climate Change Research Unit at Cayetano Heredia University in Lima, Peru. An epidemiologist, he is also a co-author of the Lancet Countdown Report on South America, which is focused on the challenges and opportunities for climate and health in the region. Now, prior to joining Cayetano Heredia, he worked on parasitology and emerging infectious diseases at the United States Naval Medical Research Unit, which was just outside Lima in Callao. And so he's really been studying the epidemiological, social, and political dimensions of dengue outbreaks for several decades. Willy, welcome to The Common Health.
Thank you, Catherine. And it's a very timely issue to talk about, but I think at the same time, we forget that it's been a permanent issue sometimes. We forget that it's been an ongoing issue of our region dealing with these dengue outbreaks and epidemics in multiple countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting looking back. I guess there have been dengue outbreaks for several centuries, at least, you know, what is known if you look at the descriptions of some of the outbreaks, even in the 18th century and the 19th century. But, you know, really this current situation is quite concerning. Now, at the end of February, the government in Peru declared a health emergency in most of the country's districts over the current outbreak. As you said, it's been a health challenge for several decades, but this situation seems to be more severe. So I just wanted to start out by asking you, like, what exactly is dengue? Why has it been so difficult to control the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the disease vector? And what are the regions in Peru and populations most vulnerable to severe disease?
Dengue fever has a range of presentations, as you described early in your introduction. Actually, most of the people who get exposed to dengue by the bite of an infected Aedes mosquito will only have a symptomatic presentation. They will not have symptoms. Most of the people exposed do not show anything. Maybe they'll have a very mild headache or malaise, and they will not know that they've been infected. And then a fraction of cases get a clinical recognizable disease, and then a fraction of those, a small fraction, have the severe presentation that can have a rapid progression into death in a again, another fraction of them. But it's a disease that can affect large groups of populations because of the abundance in most of our settings of the mosquito. That's because of the vulnerabilities of regions like Latin America and tropical areas of Latin America, where people live in very close proximity in large numbers in big cities and with inadequate sanitation or access to water that generates the conditions for the mosquitoes to breed and grow in large numbers. To that vulnerability, it's added that the control measures for dealing with the mosquito population are not terribly effective. They require a very active and continuous participation of the community, because you can have Aedes breeding sites in many different parts of a community, in, you know, multiple water containers within a house and within multiple houses in one block. So these are control measures to eliminate these reservoirs that are hard to maintain effectively over time, over, you know, weeks, over months, over years. Population gets tired, population gets, you know, less concerned about the disease. Sometimes they lower their guard and the mosquito populations grow. And then when it comes an emergency, like we're dealing with one right now, populations of mosquitoes are so large that we only have an alternative to fumigate mosquitoes with insecticides that, again, are also difficult to bring to all the places where mosquito populations are. Insecticides that are have growing rates of resistance, and in general, they require a logistic system that is really difficult to operate in the middle of a health emergency. And on the disease side, there's no treatment for the disease that is effective. So it's very difficult to control this disease with the options or alternatives we have right now. And that's why controlling an epidemic is such a challenge. And sometimes you need to think of when your best chance is to control the disease, that is probably in the inter-epidemic periods where the mosquito populations are low and there's less transmission of disease. And there you may have the greater chances of reducing the population numbers of mosquito, reducing circulation of the disease to such low levels that it doesn't come back to literally bite you in the next epidemic season.
Let me ask you about the sanitation issues that you mentioned. The Aedes aegypti thrives in urban environments, it sounds like. And so is this, like, if people are, they don't have access to, you know, piped water on a regular basis, or they don't have a good way to store it, then they'll bring containers of water into the house, or there may not be drainage. And so there's water, and this is where the mosquito is able to breed. So is that what you're saying is part of the challenge around sanitation and drainage?
Yes, that is a big part of the challenge. And maybe to that, maybe we need to preface it with the description of a different setting as well, that is maybe more unique to countries like Peru and some of the other more non-tropical desertic areas of South America. But this also happens in other regions of the world. In desertic areas, people don't have running water, and then you need to store water in your homes to, you know, cook, drink, shower, basically all your needs. So yes, definitely in those settings, those water containers, they're often not properly closed despite multiple campaigns from ministries of health. And mosquitoes go in and drop their eggs and lay their eggs, and then mosquitoes grow. But you have the other setting of the really tropical areas urban as well, but large in large densities of population, but where you have rainwater. Mm-hmm. And people don't need to store water to drink, and they may even have, you know, running water access permanently. But there is the opposite. The rainwater comes and it stores in anything from, you know, a half-cut soda bottle, mm-hmm, or a coconut shell. And there the mosquito has adapted to live in any of these, you know, temporary places, and lay their eggs and then raise another batch of mosquitoes in large number of unused containers or trash even. So that's the other part of the sanitation. It's not running water. Mm-hmm. It's not absence of running water. It's sanitation to pick up these large amounts of trash where the mosquito can make viable breeding habitats. So you have two different settings, both urban, and both happen in highly dense populations. You have the dry settings of cities in Peruvian coast, like Piura, Tumbes, Chiclayo, Trujillo, and now more up and coming Lima. And it's probably going to continue moving south. And then you have the other setting of these tropical cities. Think of Rio de Janeiro, think of Sao Paulo, Guayaquil, San Juan de Puerto Rico, and, you know, most of their big cities. So you have these two different scenarios. And Aedes is such a flexible, adaptable mosquito that thrives in any, it adapts very well to the conditions that they have.
So we've got the sanitation challenges on one hand, and then the problem with the insecticide and the increasing resistance to insecticide on the other. Your work has also, you know, really examined this intersection of climate change and emerging diseases in the South America region. And so I wanted to ask you to say a little bit too about the extent to which the current outbreaks are connected to the, I guess, the El Nino phenomenon, and to what extent they're also being driven by just increasing heat and other kinds of changing climate conditions.
No, definitely. The reports of the Lancet Countdown for Climate Change and Health since its inception has looked at diseases that are more suitable to transmit because of climate change. And globally, that has been shown very clearly to be increasing over time, particularly for diseases like that are transmitted by Aedes mosquitoes like dengue, chikungunya, and Zika. Mm-hmm. We published the 2022 report last year in March in the Lancet Americas Journal. We took one of those indicators for the climatic suitability to dengue in South America. And that clearly has been increasing for, you know, since the 1960s, and has increased 30+% since, and with a sharp increase in the 70s and 80s that has taken us where we are right now. So right now, with the record level temperatures that we are experiencing almost every year, we have additional peaks on already more suitable environment for Aedes and for dengue transmission purely as a result of climatic variables. And that is a very vulnerable scenario because it means that our control measures every year, they're less and less effective just because of climatic factors. And we need more effort, naturally more resources, to obtain similar results that we had in the past. And that happens in the context of a global, you know, recessive economy and mm-hmm. a post-COVID pandemic with weakened health systems and a very political and stable environment. So it's a perfect storm scenario. Now, the climate factors and climate scenario is not new. It's something that we knew a while ago. And the relationship between climate and dengue was really well known. It has a very clear seasonality that we knew all along. And after having a few El Niño events recently, where these unusual extreme scenarios, we have large outbreaks and epidemics of dengue coming up, it would have been expected that after important El Niño last year that extended the summer and then it shortened importantly the winter, mm-hmm. it was just expected to have a massive epidemic this year. It was the perfect conditions. Mosquito populations never got to be low, and the temperature remained high year long. We had a very, you know, weak winter last year, very short. So that was the moment that we needed to prepare in that inter-epidemic period of last year. And we really need to invest a lot of effort because this, I mean, it's hard to predict things very accurately, but this was expected. This was a very highly likely event. And now we're paying the consequences of not being ready, particularly because the effects, because of this short winter, probably have started really early. Like the increase of cases started not, you know, in February where we usually have it, but in December, in several countries. And now it's in a snowball situation that is almost impossible to stop.
I mean, if you look at the graphs of kind of when the cases seem to peak, it looks like it's more toward like May, June, July. But already this year, I mean, the numbers are much higher than, you know, not as high as that period, not as high as May, June, July, but, you know, it's certainly much higher than they have been in the past. Let me ask you, you know, so if this has been a well-known, you know, possibility for, well, certainly dengue has been a present reality for several decades, and knowing both about the increasing heat and the heat waves and then the shorter winter and the El Nino cycle of the past year and this year, you know, the health emergency declaration enabled, you know, the declaration was made, I guess, at the end of February, and certainly that enables the flow of financial and human resources to affected areas to begin to take emergency measures, standing up temporary clinics and providing other services for people. But, you know, why, I guess, if these outbreaks had been anticipated, why do you think the health sector, you know, kind of finds itself unprepared? Is it still dealing with the aftershocks of COVID? And then, of course, there was some of the political turmoil around the ministry last year. Like, what are some of the factors that kind of underpin this crisis within the health system? And, you know, what are some of the steps that can be taken to really kind of enhance preparedness for future outbreaks like this?
I think the word is preparedness, not response, because responding to an epidemic of dengue of the magnitude that we're dealing with right now is nearly impossible. It takes so much extent of efforts that it's difficult to launch it in multiple areas of a country at the same time in an effective way. And in the middle of a health crisis where people are really concerned and dealing with their own health problems. So the key here is to start way before the epidemic curve starts its, that, you know, really sharp rise, like maybe a few months before, in order to have a fighting chance to address the risk. There are some administrative processes, at least here in Peru, at the beginning of every calendar year that but prevent a continuous effort, because a lot of contracts for personnel end in December and they need to restart in January, but they don't restart in the job, the processes to hire people start again in January. So people are actually hired sometime in February and in their place, or late in January in the best case scenario. So trying to do things in a new calendar year is really tough. And we all know that. We all that have been in a position in the Ministry of Health or government, we know how the cycle goes. So we probably would have needed to have this level of effort sometime in October, and then devise a mechanism to go through the end of the fiscal year, maintaining the amount of effort.
I see. So really keeping those contracts kind of not ending in December and then having to be renegotiated, but having something that bridges over the critical period when these cases might have been kind of brewing.
Yes. And accelerated processes and, you know, a combination of efforts, because we all know what happens in January. But in general, to start earlier than the mosquito is key here. And of course, not to take a break when the mosquito is busy growing, and people are moving, you know, around at the end of the year. So if you have an outbreak that is starting in December, and then you have people traveling for the holidays and moving virus and spreading virus in different directions, you're creating a scenario that it's very challenging to address. Again, with tools that for control that are of limited effectiveness, as we all know after using them for years.
So let me ask you about the dengue vaccine. There's a new vaccine available, I think, from Takeda, the Qdenga vaccine. Brazil has launched a campaign to reach several million people over the next couple of years, I think largely targeting adolescents for vaccinations, but the supply is not huge, and it sounds like it may take a while for supplies to increase. But how much of a game changer do you think vaccines for dengue will be, and what should we be looking for there?
I think vaccines have the potential to completely change the landscape of dengue control. We just need to see how they work over multiple seasons and epidemics. And with dengue, my recollection is that serotypes 3 and 4 have not been yet well studied. So it would be great to have that data to see how they can be used. And then with the Butantan vaccine, you know, results just recently published in the New England Journal with only one dose, and also high levels of efficacy, that can have the potential of accelerate protection to the population. But we're talking about, as you mentioned, the future. This is not something that sadly will make a big dent on the current epidemics in most ways, but they will eventually be more effective tools that we can add to the arsenal, and in combination with other measures will probably make us better able to prevent epidemics over time in populations that are high risk in the places that we know already have always been at risk, in the groups, in the populational groups that we know are at risk. So I think it's a big part of the future, but we need to still consider a mix of interventions for quite a while until we can get a better handle on control that not a lot of people have achieved.
Right. Well, and it sounds like there are multiple products that are under development and under study. So, you know, as some of those come forward, you know, maybe that supply will change as well. So we've talked a little bit about the Lancet Countdown report on South America, and you were one of the co-authors of that. The report, you know, really calls on governments to scale up preparedness for the health impacts of climate change, both on the, you know, to, you know, improve the resilience of the health sector in responding, and, you know, adapting to some of the changing conditions, but also to reduce deforestation, to decarbonize the energy and transportation sectors, and accelerate the transition to the use of renewable energy sources in many of the countries. These changes, of course, require political will, financial commitments, and importantly, the support of the population. You know, you talked a little bit in the beginning about some of the challenge of working with communities on dealing with AIDS prevention, taking those steps within their households or within their communities, that people get tired of doing some of these things over time. And so I wanted to just ask you to say a little bit about communicating about something like the challenge of dengue or the broader intersection of climate and health. You know, are there challenges around communication and misinformation that are important to address? And what do you see as some of the opportunities to really kind of raise awareness about these issues within the popular consciousness so that there can, you know, be a, you know, a movement to press political figures and decision makers to really take action on some of these issues?
I think there's a big agenda, as the report says, in at all levels, from the highest political level, to really commit to address climate change, to support adaptation and the development of more resilient health systems as well, and mitigation measures. And the structural mesh that you have mentioned, but there's one particularly that is very important for us in South America, that is to protect the Amazon from, specifically from reaching a turning point in which it becomes no longer a space that can absorb CO2. Really, that is such a critical issue for us. And there's been recent legislation approved by the Peruvian Congress that supports the extended efforts for deforestation in the Amazon that are really damaging, and they're going to have important consequences long term if that legislation is finally passed and placed into action. So that's something simple that can be done at this moment. And this crisis should be an opportunity to recognize these turning points in which we are. The other ones that, you know, the others that you mentioned, like the dependence on fossil fuels, the existence of huge subsidies to fossil fuels, which we stop and we can get a co-benefit in health of not just the cleaner environment, but also reduce impacts in health. I mean, there's just so much, but I think in critical moments like this, I think this is when political actors may realize the importance of these long-term decisions. We also know that in these critical moments, the budgets are looked and scrutinized to see where funds can be invested in short-term actions. But I think we need to look at the long-term as well, very importantly. The communication with the population and with local actors, it is definitely important. And we need to continue coming up ways to reach the population and let them become more familiar with both what they can do regarding climate change, but also what they can do regarding AIDS and AIDS control and dengue prevention. Like, we're gonna need to reach now large cities like Lima and cities farther down south in Peru and in other countries, because every year dengue reaches new borders, new places. So there's a lot of communication to do in areas that have not been historically endemic for dengue, and need to make it part of people's culture, the addressing of dengue and dengue risk. But at the same time, there's some intermediate level where decision making is important. And we continue to live in, I'm not sure it's only Peru, I think it happens in other countries, that our fight with climate change is divided between the environmental sector, ministries of environment and other entities, and the addressing of the health consequences in the ministries of health and public health systems. And those two groups, environment and health, they continue to work separately. And they do not, and efforts are different magnitudes and scales, and they don't integrate efforts. And I think that divide needs to be bridged. The decision-making should not be so fragmented. Other local intermediate actors need to be more present, like mayors, and to act in their own spaces as well. Not everything needs to come from central level. So there are multiple avenues and spaces for action in this fight that we need to involve and incorporate. And again, these moments of crisis are important, and we need to learn from them and take advantage of the current scenario in that way.
So it's March right now, but at least looking at previous calendars, the worst months for the dengue outbreak, at least last year, looked like they were in June and July. So as you look ahead over the next couple of months, what steps do you hope to see taken in the short term in terms of kind of the communication and the response? You know, in the longer term, to what extent do you think outbreaks like this one and others that are connected to the changing climate, you know, will really begin to manifest as bigger issues in elections, whether, you know, and the political system, whether at the kind of the municipal and district level or really, you know, into the national and regional context?
Maybe I'll start with the last part that you mentioned. And I think we really lost an opportunity here in Peru, at least, to make decisions in their last election cycles based on positions regarding climate change. Mm-hmm. And I think that needs to be more in our radar in the next election cycle at multiple levels, president, Congress, mayors. We need to put that more in the agenda. And the connection between climate change and health needs to be part of our discussion of what we need to do, including climate adaptation plans, city level or, you know, a regional country level. But so I think that needs to be part of our decision making in the medium to long term. In the short term, I think it's important to provide the same level of support to the preventive efforts as well as to the curative efforts for responding to the current dengue scenario. Because if, you know, we focus more on the curative side, set up emergency hospitals and others, still the number of cases can even grow beyond our expectations. So we need to be very careful in providing the right dimension to the control efforts on both mosquito population and breeding sites across the country. The other element that needs to be present in the response is measurement. It's not just a matter of doing and then counting cases. We need to implement control measures and try to assess their efficacy with evaluation components. And not just logistical of how many hours, you know, or you know, how many, you know, tons of insecticide were spread or how many teams, But what happened with mosquito population densities over time and what other indicators we need in order to understand what is the effect of our investments in real scenario, in pragmatic conditions that are very different than, you know, our estimates and models. And the communication to the population is definitely important, but sometimes the media and the language that we use, including myself, can be too technical and too far away from what people, how people communicate and talk and how they perceive the risks. So we need to get to that bridge and use local voices and use local actors from communities affected so they can reach more effectively the population.
Well, so this is a really easy agenda, right? We've got to improve sanitation and water. We need to improve vector control. We need to bring environment and health together and maybe around shared indicators, but also really improve communications across the spectrum, both, you know, in terms of regional and national political discussions, but also kind of how dengue is affecting people at the local level and really empower them as voices for change and really a movement for improving the greater preparedness at the political level. I think that's not just a 3-month agenda, but hopefully it will get started in 3 months and certainly is ongoing. But I hope perhaps we can circle back and have another conversation later this year to see how some of this is taking shape.
And maybe really important to circle back at a moment where we're not at the peak or an ascending stage of the epidemic, but in the moment where we're starting the inter-epidemic period and see what are we doing in that time? What are we doing in the moment that we have a break where we can actually be more effective?
Yeah, take a step back and reflect on, you know, what lessons have been learned and, you know, where can there be greater mobilization and collaboration, right, across sectors for future outbreaks. Willie Lascano, thank you very much for joining me today. And good luck to you and your colleagues as you continue to work and research and write about and really kind of develop greater understanding of the links between climate and health, and in particular, this focus on dengue. And I look forward to talking with you again. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Common Health. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a follow and leave a review. To learn more about the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security or listen to other CSIS podcasts, please visit csis.org.